Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 31st of March, 2021, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined by Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Good morning, Phil. How are you doing?
Morning, David. I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm looking rather longingly out of the window at bright sunshine and rising temperatures at the moment, but I'm stuck in here in the cold.
Well, it's lovely here too, but Easter weekend coming up and apparently the temperature's going to drop back down again, but at least our eggs won't melt.
That's Oh, well. Anyway, Phil, end of March. Can't believe that we're 3 months into the year already. What's caught your eye this week? What in terms of news?
Well, there's a few news stories of significance. I suppose the first one that comes to mind is there's a new pre-qualification, common assessment standard for procuring suppliers has gone live this week. And this is supposed to be a major cost saver. They say that currently the duplication of time, effort and resources costs the sector up to £1 billion a year in small companies bidding for work or subcontractors bidding for work from tier one contractors. And so Build UK has come up with this new industry-wide pre-qualification system that a lot of the big contractors have all signed up to, which means that now, I'm not a procurement expert, I don't entirely understand it, but essentially it means that you've got three assessment bodies, Achilles, Chas and Construction Line, and everything's going to go through one of those three. The bottom line is it's supposed to make things a lot easier for the supply chain.
This is just for public sector procurement, presumably.
I think we already have it in the public sector. I think this is the big contractors in Build UK. Balfour Beatty, Costain, Mace, Multiplex, Skanska. They've all adopted this new common assessment standard, new way of shortlisting or procuring suppliers, sharing the data so that the small company doesn't have to send in lots of forms to lots of different people the whole time. It can just send in one form and say, here's us, this is who we are, kind of thing. Don't ask us again. But I don't really want to talk about that at length this morning because it's all about paperwork. And as we all know, paperwork's boring and dull. It has to be done, important, but we're not going to talk about that.
Okay, so what else have we got?
Another thing is come across my desk just this morning, which I think is very interesting. It's an organisation I've not heard of for a while, or heard about for a while, an organisation called CROSS, which was born out of the Standing Committee on Structural Safety, SCOS. CROSS was started in 2005 as a confidential reporting on structural safety. And it's a whistleblowing service that's jointly run by the Institution of Civil Engineers and the Institution of Structural Engineers. And it's inspired by, very much based on, what airline pilots have got. If you've got a near miss or something's worrying you in the airline industry, pilots or other crew, I guess, can flag up, wave a flag, blow the whistle without losing their jobs, because it's important that structural safety issues are aired in a confidential, responsible way and taken on board by appropriate authorities and so on.
Yeah.
Anyway, the news this morning is that CROSS is no longer the confidential reporting on structural safety. It is now collaborative reporting for safer structures. So it's still CROSS. But the reason why it's not structural safety but safer structures is because it now is not just to do with whether buildings are going to fall down. It's also to do with whether buildings and structures are going to catch fire. This is all part of the Grenfell Tower Hackett report into the Grenfell Tower fire. It makes absolute sense and everyone agrees that the fire safety of structures is as important as the structural safety of structures. And so now the remit of cross has been widened to include fire, which is interesting, sensible, obvious. I'm not sure there's much more to say on it, though.
No, okay. No, I mean, I know that fire is certainly a big issue with steel frame buildings, because everybody assumes that a steel frame building being made out of steel is very robust, but steel's highly vulnerable, susceptible to fire. You remember the BRE did a massive full-scale test at Cardington in those huge airship hangars?
Yes,
once.
Yes,
an eight-story steel-framed building, and they set fire to it repeatedly to see how well it performed. So I can, obviously it makes perfect sense to include fire safety, especially in the light of Grenfell Tower into this. So yeah, that's an interesting one. I'll follow that with interest.
Well, actually, I went to the Cross website on having been prompted to think about what they were up to and look at what they're up to, which is cross-safety.org. And it's interesting to see a report up there on the risk of collapse of multi-storey CLT, which is cross-laminated timber buildings, mm-hmm. during a fire. You mentioned steel buildings.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean, CLT, cross-laminated timber, is excellent in so many ways, and is not as much of a fire hazard as you might assume just because it's made of wood. But there's a report there expressing concerns about their risk of collapse in the event of an uncontrolled fire. So there's more than just steel buildings, all sorts of interesting stuff on that website, and well worth checking out if you have any responsible for building safety, building design. Interesting organisation.
Yeah, definitely.
Next news item running through my list of the week. We had that nice man, Peter Launer, the chair of the Construction Industry Training Board, on last week.
Yes.
That was a good conversation. Talking.
It was
about
very interesting, yes.
Yeah, talking about the colleges being closed. Do you remember I asked him how much it was going to cost the CITB to keep the colleges open?
Yes.
And he said, we've got a new business plan coming out next week. In other words, I'm not going to tell you. You'll have to wait and see. Well, that's now come out, their revised business plan. They wrote their business plan for April 2021 to March 2025. That's sort of the four years, financial years. They wrote that business plan last September, 6 months ago. And as soon as they decided they were keeping the National Construction Colleges at Bertram Newton and in Glasgow, they realised they had to go a little bit back to the drawing board. They had to think again about their business plan. And what we've learnt from that is that running the two construction colleges is going to cost them £65.5 million over the next 4 years and bring in £32.4 million in income. So it means that on a fully absorbed overhead basis, they're going to lose £32.7 million over the next 4 years. So you can see why they perhaps wanted to find a buyer to take these colleges off their hands.
Yes, yes.
So that's, filling in the gaps from last week there.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's a quick run through the latest news. But there's one story, of course, which I'm particularly keen to discuss. And it's not, strictly speaking, construction, I suppose. I mean, it's civil engineering of a sort.
I think it's absolutely civil engineering. I know where you're going.
Right. Go on, go on. Where am I going then, Phil?
I think you're crossing oceans and finding your way down or trying to get through a narrow canal.
Heading for the Red Sea. Heading for the Red Sea. Yeah, yeah. We're talking about the Ever Given, which strangely named ship, massive container ship, which everybody I'm sure will know, got wedged across the Suez Canal last week. Absolutely massive ship, and with huge ramifications, because of course the Suez Canal is a very important trade route, one of the most important trade routes in ocean navigation, I assume. And of course it was all systems go to try and get this thing refloated and out of the way so that other ships could use the canal. And it was a Dutch dredging firm, Boskalis Westminster, that came to the rescue in the end and did what Dutch dredging contractors do, shifted an awful lot of muck and got the thing refloated in time. I think, was it only yesterday that they refloated it, or was it the day before? But yeah, quite a big operation because of the numbers involved. I mean, the ship itself is absolutely massive. I think
400 metres long.
400 metres long, yeah. Absolutely ridiculous. Gross tonnage of 219,000 tonnes. And these are some figures I just got off the internet. It's got a capacity of 20,000 TEUs, ton equivalent units. So it's absolutely stacked up with containers with all sorts of stuff, presumably coming from China. Yeah, so Boskalis rode to the rescue. Did you watch any of the commentary on this, Phil?
I did, and it's you talk about it being big, and we've talked before about things being measured in double-decker buses and Olympic yes. swimming pools and half the size of whales and things.
Football pitches, and, yeah.
Well, they've been talking about this in terms of, I think, it, is it the length of the Empire State Building's height, and it weighs, I can't remember how many Eiffel Towers or something. And this is
right, okay,
this
yeah.
The units that are now being dug out to measure things. How many Eiffel Towers is that?
Yeah.
I mean, it is absolutely huge. And there's one picture I've actually got on my screen in front of me from Reuters of a relatively modest-looking hydraulic crawler excavator digging out a little bit of earth. And there's
yeah.
various comments I've seen online about how the operator of that digger has suddenly got the whole world's economy resting on his shoulders as to how quickly yeah. he can dig out this huge great container ship.
Yeah, I saw that picture as well, because I mean, it's not a particularly small excavator. I don't know, I estimate, but 20 or 30 tons, something like that. But
no,
of course,
it's
completely
dwarfed. Yes,
absolutely dwarfed by the bow of this ship. There it is, it's sort of manfully digging out bucketfuls of sand. But when you think about it, it's a drop in the ocean, almost literally, I suppose. I was quite impressed by the, I don't know anything about ships, to be perfectly honest, but they drafted in a couple of big ocean-going tugs to try and pull it off. Obviously, by dredging and digging, you can sort of alleviate some of the friction, I suppose. But they had to pull it off in the end with tugs. And one of them, this tug has a pulling force of something like 285 tons. So that's a hell of a lot of thrust, pulling this thing off the sand. And this is another thing which I think means that they were very lucky, because the bed of the Suez Canal, I think, is just sand and mud rather than rock, which means that you can just suck the stuff out and get rid of it. But obviously, if you're shifting, I think, 30,000 tons of this stuff, it takes a bit of time. But luckily, it wasn't rock it was sitting on. It was just sand. So they managed to get it off. And the other thing which was extremely lucky was something which you could have seen out of your bedroom window last night, which is the full moon. The fact that they had a full moon when they were doing this meant that they had extremely high tides. And when the tide came in, that helped to refloat the boat. And they managed to drag it off the sand and get it pulled to one side of the canal and the other ships could come through. So that was quite interesting.
You say that it's lucky that it's sand at the bottom of the canal rather than rock, but presumably if it was rock, it wouldn't have sunk into rock. It would have
bounced off it.
Perhaps bounced off and been, yeah. you know, it wouldn't have been embedded in it in the same way it got embedded in the sand.
That's true, yes. Yeah, I suppose that is absolutely true. But, I mean, I don't know how it got stuck in the first place. I'm assuming that, I don't know, it lost power or something and then just drifted. But it does make you realise how vulnerable the entire world economy is, that something like this can threaten to pull it to a halt.
Well, what I like about this story, what I find so... the journalist in me finds so appealing about this story is it's got the whole world's attention. Everyone all over the world is equally interested and fascinated by this.
Yeah.
It's not Brexit. It's not COVID. It's not Donald Trump. It's something more transitory, I suppose, and no one's been hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, often these big stories which attract the nation's interest are, the world's interest are tsunamis or hurricanes or earthquakes or something. But as far as we know, no one's been hurt in this. So it's been quite benign. I mean, yes, a lot of trade's been held up and, you know, a lot of garden centres are going to have to wait for their garden furniture to replenish stocks and things like that. And I'm sure there are more important things than that that might be being held up. But in the grand scheme of things, this is just almost a sporting spectacle.
Yeah, almost. It's, yeah, because it's very visual.
We're all sort of watching and waiting for people to rescue.
Yeah.
Rescue this this container ship.
One thing that, of course, it did focus attention on was, as I alluded to earlier, the preeminence of the Dutch in anything sort of maritime and sort of marine construction. They are, you know, from the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike right through to the Ever Given. If you've got a problem with sea defences or flooding or anything
they're the go-to people.
Yeah, go to the Netherlands, because they usually know how to sort it out. And in fact, there's quite a big sea defence operation happening down on the south coast of England near Portsmouth. It's the South Sea Defences project. Contractors started work on that, I think, last September, and that's a joint venture of Volker Stevin, I believe. Yeah, Volker Stevin and Boskalis Westminster. So Boskalis again, you know, there they are doing coastal defences, which they do all over Europe. Well, all over the world, I guess.
There's certain inevitability that the Dutch would have historic and traditional expertise in these things, because it's such a low-lying country.
Yeah.
And it exists because of coastal defences, I think, on the whole, the Netherlands. But they do seem to, the Dutch, along with the Scottish, they seem to punch above their weight globally. For,
yeah, you know,
a small country, not a huge population. And the impact, you think of the it seems like the British Empire was physically built by Scottish engineers.
Yes.
The Scottish engineers have always seemed to have a much greater role around the world.
Yes.
than a country their size, the size of Scotland, you might expect. And similarly with the Dutch, and not just in dredging, an awful lot of engineering and heavy lifting and,
yeah,
moving and shifting. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. I wonder why certain nations tend to sort of become preeminent in something like that. I suppose it sort of feeds upon itself. As you say, obviously the Netherlands, a vast proportion of their land mass is actually reclaimed from the sea. So they do this, you know, day in, day out. It's what they do. So it's not really surprising that they should be particularly good at sort of marine engineering, because they owe their national existence to it. But you're right about the Scottish. They export engineering excellence all over the world. They still do, and they always have.
The other great Dutch rescue job, or it's a salvage job rather than a rescue. People were had already been killed in this one, but the operation being, you know, calling in the Dutch to save the day reminds me, 20 years ago it was now, when another Dutch company, Mammoet,
mm-hmm,
carried out the salvage of the Kursk submarine.
The Russian submarine,
the,
yeah,
Kursk was a Russian nuclear submarine which had exploded and sunk with, I can't remember how many people killed on board. And it was down there for 14 months before the salvage operation was put into action and carried out. What the key to that was essentially using hydraulic strand jacks on a
big barge, presumably.
Big barge is the word I'm looking for. A barge on top, huge, great strand jacks. Because what they had to be really careful how they lifted up this sub. If it broke up in any way, there could be, you know, nuclear explosions and bombs going off and whatever. So they had to lift it up really, really carefully. And strand jacks was the answer. And strand jacks are quite simple and amazingly useful piece of lifting technology. They're not given to the radio. I couldn't begin to, anyone listening who doesn't know what a strand jack is, I couldn't begin to explain how they work.
Well, if you know what a collet chuck is, that gives you a clue.
A what?
A collet chuck. A collet
chuck.
Go on, then.
Well, what's a collet chuck?
A collet chuck. Well, a collet chuck.
It's a bit like a strand jack, isn't it?
Well, no, you've got your strand, which is wire rope. Is it wire rope or steel rod?
Usually a wire rope, yes.
Which is gripped in a chuck. And you know what a chuck is, because you've got an electric drill, right? Well, a collet chuck has the jaws of the chuck are tapered, and they sit in a sort of a cup. So as the jaws are forced into the tapered cup, they close in and grip whatever's between them. And I think that's how a strand jack works. You've got a hydraulic jack which raises this cup, and the strand goes through the collet jaws as you apply the lifting force, it grips the strand, lifts it up, and then you presumably hold it with something else, withdraw the hydraulic jack, which automatically opens the collet, and then it closes around the strand again, and you do another stroke and lift it even further. That's enough strand jacks.
Well, it's the same principle. I've got a different way of explaining it, which might be repetition. But if you're climbing up a tree or a mountain or a vertical sheer face, and you might have a I don't know what the tools are called. I'm not a climber, but the grippy tool in your left hand and the grippy tool between your feet, and you lift up one, you lift up your hand and grip the rope above above you, and then your feet grip comes up, and you're basically putting one hand over the other, or you're ignore my feet bit, climbing a rope, putting one hand over the other, gripping as you go, so that essentially the rope is being passed through two grips, one at a time, and that's how a rope
that's the same basic principle. Okay, well, without the benefit of visuals, I don't know how many of our listeners are going to actually appreciate what we were talking about there. They might have thought we'd gone off our rockers.
We're going to get on the subject of self-climbing tower cranes now. It's even harder to explain without visuals. But thinking about the role of the Dutch in salvaging the Kursk submarine using strandjacks, it did make me think. Thinking about the use of strandjacks in the raising of the Kursk did make me think whether there might not have been a role for them in rescuing the Ever Given, where they couldn't have some moorings on the side of the canal, something with, I don't know whether you get the foundation solid enough to get an anchor point on the foundations. But if you had an anchor point on either side of the canal, you could use hydraulic strand jacks to
drag it
to pull. Yeah. And I thought, but it would give a lot more force, I would have thought, than a tugboat.
Well, yes, I would assume it would. As I said, that ocean-going tug has a pulling force of something like 285 tonnes, which isn't really an awful lot compared to the 224,000 tonnes of the ship. But it's quite a lot for a boat to be able to pull. But yeah, I suppose a problem with that, of course, would be to actually find an anchor firm enough on the bank to pull against, because you're going to have to exert an awful lot of pressure, and I suppose it would have taken them months to build something big enough to withstand that sort of tension. So I imagine that's why they didn't do it.
Well, I'm just looking up the I've just quick googled, actually. I mentioned the Kursk Smit were involved as well. I think Smit were involved in the Suez. They used 26 strandjacks, each of which can lift up to 900 metric tons.
Wow.
So that's, you know, whatever that is, more than 2,000 tons, 2,500 tons or something, capacity, which is much more than those tugs could pull.
Yeah. Well, it's a shame they didn't ask you, Phil. They could have had it. Could have had it out by the weekend.
If the Dutch were there, they would have been all over the strandjacks idea. And I can only assume it's the anchor points.
Inhibiting
issue.
Absolutely, that's a big problem, big heavy problem. But they fixed it.
But it made me think of other great rescue missions, other great saves. I mean, of course, the greatest save ever. There was, you know, Gordon Banks against Pelé in 1970. But aside from sporting, the other great rescue mission that I think of, some films I've enjoyed, Raid on Entebbe.
Oh, yeah.
Where the Israeli armed services rescued hostages in an airport in Uganda in 1976.
Yeah.
Then there's Lewis Collins in Who Dares Wins, the dramatisation of the SAS rescuing hostages from the Iranian embassy in London in 1980. Yeah. That was a great rescue operation.
It was. They didn't use strandjacks, though. They used firearms, I think. Firearms and stun grenades.
there was definitely rope involved, climbing into the building, dropping down into the building, sudden smashing through the windows.
That was a long time ago, because I was at university then when that happened, so very long time ago. But I was thinking of another rescue, slightly less dramatic rescue operation, and much delayed rescue operation that was televised live, which I can remember watching shortly after I left university, which was the raising of the Mary Rose in the Solent. And Mary Rose, you may remember, was Henry VIII's, well, you wouldn't remember, but you might know, was Henry VIII's flagship, which sank rather embarrassingly in the middle of a battle in the Solent against some French galleys. They sailed up alongside these galleys, opened up the gun ports, rolled out the guns, fired a broadside, and then decided to go about so that they could present the other side of the ship and fire the other broadside, which they did with great alacrity. So they went about and they were turning and they got hit by a nasty squall, and they had done it rather hastily, and before they had closed the gun ports on the leeward side of the boat. So it heeled over, the water rushed in and sank the boat before they could fire the other, I say boat, ship obviously, before they could fire the other broadside. So that was in about 1540 something, and the ship gradually broke up and disappeared. Apparently it was a huge embarrassment because it was a big obstacle in the middle of the Solent, and eventually it broke up and disappeared, but people still knew it was there, and I think they found some bits of it in the 19th century. And then in 1982, I think, they actually mounted, they knew where it was, they'd done a lot of underwater archaeology, and they've retrieved some bits and bobs. They decided they were going to raise it, and this was the first time I ever saw a floating crane, and this was on the television.
Was that Smith as well?
I've got a funny feeling it was.
One of the Smittac 7 or something like that.
Yes, the crane barge had a strange name, Togmore or something it was. I don't know if that's Scottish or Dutch. Togmore, I think, was the name of the crane ship. I might be completely wrong. But they built this cradle, this steel cradle, so that they could actually build it underwater around the wreck, because there was only about a third of the ship actually still there. It'd been buried in sand and mud, and it had been protected for 500 years. So everything above the seabed had been washed away. But they excavated it, they built this frame around it, and then they raised the frame with the boat in it. So up it came, and it's now on display in Portsmouth. I think it's Portsmouth, in a special museum. I've been to see it a long, long time ago, not long after it came up. But rather an interesting relic. And of course, it yielded loads and loads of information, loads of artifacts and things like this that told us lots of things about naval warfare in the Tudor times that we didn't know before. But that was a fascinating job. And, you know, it was, again, I think it was broadcast live. I definitely remember watching it on the television as they raised this thing. So it was quite a dramatic operation. Shall we move on to another topic, Phil?
Yeah, what you got?
I want to talk about the magazine, obviously.
Excellent.
The current issue is out now, of course. The March issue, it's been out for a week or two. Packed full of good features, as always. And there's one I particularly wanted to talk about, which is something we haven't really discussed before. The general topic is recruitment, training, that kind of thing, which, of course, is a perennial topic. And it's a big preoccupation for the industry because we were always short of skilled workers in the industry, people, you know, across the board. And there have been various schemes to recruit various sectors of the population. You know, we're always talking about we need to get more women into the construction industry, more ethnic minorities, stuff like that. And this is all true because there's an imbalance there. Another sector of the community, of the population, if you like, which is often touted as being really good candidates for construction, are, of course, ex-servicemen. People who are used to working outdoors, doing arduous work, that kind of thing.
Working as a team.
Yeah, working as a team. You know, they leave the Army or the Navy or the Air Force, they need to find another job. Well, construction has a lot to offer them. But there's one sector that perhaps people overlook, and in fact, this is what the feature's about. People are overlooking it, although some contractors are beginning to pay attention to it, and that's ex-offenders. Obviously, the idea of prison is to rehabilitate. And you want people to leave prison having turned a corner, gone straight and looking for a job. And we've got a feature here written by a freelancer called Paul Thompson, who spoke to a Barnsley-based concrete frame contractor called Cidon Construction, C-I-D-O-N Construction, who have a relationship with an open prison in Cheshire, HMP Thorn Cross. And they have a programme of recruiting ex-offenders, people who have done their time, done a bit of training, they come out and then they get a job with Sidon Construction. And the interesting thing about it is that they find that ex-offenders, far from being a handful of trouble, which a lot of people might assume, you know, these people have done wrong in the past, they've gone to prison for something, and so naturally you think, can I trust them? But in actual fact, according to Steve Simpson, who's the operations director at Sidon, they make really good recruits. These people have done their time, they've been rehabilitated, they've been vetted. They're not considered to be, Norman Stanley Fletcher, you know, the hero, anti-hero of Porridge, who was a habitual criminal, always in and out of prison. These are people who have shown a willingness and a preparedness to really make a go of a career in construction. And they are loyal, hardworking, and conscientious, and make excellent recruits, according to Steve Simpson. And he's not the only one. We also spoke to Wilmot Dixon. Wilmot Dixon's interesting because they're not the only Tier 1 contractor to have recruited prison leavers, but they've got the Wilmot Dixon Foundation, which was set up, I think, in 2011, specifically to do good social value type things, and this is one of their pet projects. Wilmot Dixon actually set up a dry lining academy inside a prison at HMP Elmley in Kent.
That's right. We reported about that. I remember reporting on
that.
Yeah,
that's right. They've got a dry lining academy in the prison. So basically they can, you know, it's a seamless process. These people, obviously, they're coming to the end of their prison terms. They need to start thinking about what they're going to do when they leave. They need a job, obviously. They need to start learning because, of course, unemployment is probably the biggest cause of recidivism. If you come out of prison unprepared, you haven't got a job, how are you going to get money? What are you going to do to survive? And, of course, if you haven't got a job, then you're tempted to go back to your old ways, I suppose. So these people are trained up before they even leave the prison, and then they go out and they're basically job ready. They can go out and they can start working for contractors. And I mean, there were some interesting comments because Steve Simpson said that they get improved retention rates with their ex-offenders. And Sarah Fraser, who's the head of the Wilmot Dixon Foundation, also said that they have substantial reduction in dropout rates with ex-offenders. So, you know, this is a success story. And the thing is that I suppose there is a stigma attached. Well, there's undoubtedly a stigma attached to people who have done time in prison. And that's their biggest, the biggest obstacle they face. Coming out of prison, you know, here's my CV. Oh, you know, what have you been doing for the last 5 years? It's not a good look for an employer, and so a lot of people would just write them off without even considering them. But in actual fact, these people make good employees. Obviously, they're not. There are examples. There are exceptions, rather. Not everybody is a success, I suppose.
I looked at some statistics on this just to see about how big a potential talent pool we're talking about, and one ostensibly reliable source, it may have even been a government site, which I was staggered to see. How many adults in the UK do you think have got a criminal record?
How many adults?
How many people?
Blimey.
Let's assume children have, by and large, okay, not criminals. How many people in the UK do you think have got a criminal record?
I have no idea. Half a million?
About 10 million.
You're joking.
I was stunned, and I don't think that means parking tickets and speeding tickets. I think it means criminal record.
Yeah.
Which means the population of the UK is, what, something like 70 odd million, whatever it is. So that's about one in five adults.
Wow.
So 20% of the country, of the adults, have got a criminal record, which I actually find that...
That is staggering.
Incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
I might have to double check that one. but if that's the case, then, you know, we certainly can't afford to hold prejudice against people with a criminal record.
No, exactly. And this, as I tried to say earlier, rather clumsily, The whole point of prison, I mean, in an enlightened, civilized country, I think, rather than, you know, not, we're not talking about political prisoners, we're talking about people who have committed a crime, they go to prison. Prison only really has a value if it gives people an opportunity to reform. You know, it's supposed to help the prisoners, not as well as punish them. You know, prison has no value if it doesn't actually process these people and then release them into society as useful contributors to the rest of society. That's surely what prison is for. You know, we have to fight any reluctance to employ ex-prisoners because these are people who have been through the process and have come out of it reformed, you know, and with something to offer. And I think that, there'll be some people who, I don't know, for whatever reason, social background, mental illness, whatever, will never quite, you know, transform themselves into a useful contributor to the rest of society. They'll always be, you know, the people who are bouncing along the bottom and never really quite make it. But the majority of people are, all they need is a chance. You know, most people who go to prison have problems, drugs, emotional problems, mental problems, poverty. They're people with problems, and they're not necessarily a problem if you help them. You know, you can turn them from a problem into a useful contributor.
Another statistic I looked up was how many people are actually in prison currently. Mm-hmm. And it's about 85,000. 80,000 in men's prisons, about 5,000 women, right, roughly speaking. So that's a huge...
It is.
That's the current pool of recruits that one could look in. They're clearly in those 85,000. There are some out and out psycho wrongins who are probably never going to see the light of day. You know, your serial killers and whatever. But you know, most people are not of that order. Most of those 85,000, one would hope, are highly able to be rehabilitated. If only they get the job, the wage at the end of the week, end of the month, and the opportunity.
Well, the figures which our journalist, Paul, found show that in actual fact, longer-term prisoners are more likely to be motivated to want to stay out of prison again. I think I can quote here, figures on reoffending do not make pretty reading, says Paul. According to prisoner charity, the Prison Reform Trust, almost half of adults, 48%, are convicted of another offence within a year of their release. Government data suggests that adults released from shorter custodial sentences have a reoffending rate of around 60% over the 12 months following their release. You know, there clearly are people who, you know, they're like a bouncing ball. They're in, out, you know, getting a short custodial sentence, not long enough for them to actually reflect, change their ways, change their attitudes, learn skills, and come out motivated to take a different path. These are people we could get into a whole debate about the custodial system, but people who are given short prison sentences, which don't really have any beneficial effect. They're in there, they get resentful, they come out 6 months later, they go back to their old ways. But people who perhaps have had time to reflect, time to actually change and to adopt a different mindset, you know, these are the people who are coming out ready for a job in construction or any other industry, I'm sure. But construction is an industry which has a lot to offer.
One company outside of construction that has earned a lot of publicity, plaudits for its work in this field of rehabilitation and employment of offenders, is Timpson's, key cutting and heel repair, shoe repair chain. 1 in 10, apparently, of their workforce are ex-offenders, and they find that the turnover rate is lower among the ex-offenders. Mm. And many of them have gone on to be branch managers, mm-hmm, and so on. And this is a role very, very public-facing. You're the ambassador for the company. I mean, often when you go into a Timpson's shop, it's mm-hmm, basically a booth. There might be two people in there, but often there's only one person in there. So they are the face of the company,
yes,
to the public, And I suppose these days no one handles cash, but until relatively recently it was very much a cash business.
Yeah.
So there are kind of all sorts of reasons why you might think that would be the last place you put an ex-offender.
Yes.
But Timpson's and the family behind it said, you know, no, we're going to trust them and we're going to show that that trust will be repaid. And it's worked wonders for both sides, for the company and for the employees.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing, you know, when prison is working, prisoners or ex-prisoners, ex-offenders leave motivated to do something positive. Nobody wants to go to prison, you know. Well, I suppose maybe some people who have been in prison from, you know, from youth custody right through to adult life might not feel comfortable anywhere else. But generally speaking, nobody wants to go to prison. There's an awful, there's a strong incentive to do something better, to keep yourself out. And all you need to do is tap into that and offer somebody a real opportunity, and 9 times out of 10 they'll take it. And one thing that Steve Simpson said from Sidon is that, you know, you get huge loyalty from these guys. You know, they really appreciate the fact that you've given them a chance, because they know that they've already had one chance.
It has the potential to change everything for them.
Well, I'll give you a quote from the governor at Thorncross. Governor's called Daniel Cooper, and he says some of these lads have been in the prison system for a long time. They have families they need to support, and so earning a decent wage is very important to them. Some of them will never have had the opportunity to build a career before. You know, they're motivated to make it work. And Simpson says they are really loyal lads. They've made a mistake, they know that. They also realise that we've shown faith in them and that others have not. It doesn't work out every time, unfortunately, but that can happen regardless. Our work with Thorncross is proving very successful. So, you know, we're always talking about the skill shortage in construction. Here's a source of would-be employees who need a job and have been trained or are, you know, sort of coached to do that. So, you know, more contractors should exploit this.
Well, you've mentioned Sidon, you've mentioned Wilmot Dixon. Perhaps I ought to mention that there are many other construction companies who do work with and have schemes with prisons and so on. Keltbray, I know, are active in this field and have done lots of good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I know InterServe have had a parole service contract with the Home Office, and on the back of that, I think InterServe Construction have done work with offenders and ex-offenders.
Mm.
I think there's more that can more companies can do more to help out the ex-offenders with the care and rehabilitation of offenders.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, we've managed to avoid talking much directly about construction this week, David. I don't know what that's all about. Is there anything particularly construction-y that we should be talking about?
Put me on the spot there, Phil.
No, we'll do it next week.
Well, the only thing I would say is that a bit later I'm going to go out and start building a retaining wall. Well, that's putting it rather grandly. I've ordered 2 tonnes of ditching stone, and there's a bit of ornamental work to be done in the garden. So if I can wrap up early, I'll go out and start on that.
Well, good luck with that. You have to report back next week. Oh, finally, we are speaking on March the 31st, Wednesday. Tomorrow might be when a lot of people listen to us. If you're thinking there is an April Fool hidden within this podcast, do let us know what you think it was. podcast@reconstruction.co.uk. But from David and I, that's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.